or at least not distressed. But I was determined not to care. The only thing that really mattered was being able to speak in Kasha's defense. I knew by now that no one else here would give her a moment's thought. She didn't matter. The naming itself seemed more like another test than a ceremony. They set me at a work table and put out a bowl of water, three bowls of different powders in red and yellow and blue, a candle, and an iron bell inscribed around in letters of gold. Father Balo placed the naming spell on a sheet of parchment in front of me. The incantation was 9 long tangled words with detailed annotations that gave precise instructions on the pronunciation of every syllable and how one ought to stress each word. I muttered it over to myself, trying to fill out the important syllables, but they sat inert on my tongue. It just didn't want to come apart. "Well," Ragastak said impatiently. I slogged my awkward tongue-twisted way through the entire incantation and started to put the powder in the water, a pinch here and there. The magic of the spell gathered sluggish and reluctant. I made a brownish mess of the water, spilled some of all three kinds of powder on my skirts, and finally gave up trying to make anything better. I lit the powder, squinted through a cloud of smoke, and groped for the bell. Then I let the magic go, and the bell clanged in my hand, a long, deep note that came strangely out of so small a bell. It sounded like the great church bell in the cathedral that rang matins every morning over the city, a sound that filled the room. The metal hummed beneath my fingers as I put it down and looked around expectantly, but the name didn't write itself on the parchment, or appear in letters of flame, or anywhere at all. The wizards were all looking annoyed, older for once, not at me. Father Bella said to Alyosha in some irritation, "Was that meant for a joke?" She was frowning. She reached out to the bell and picked it up and turned it over. There wasn't a clapper inside it at all. They all stared into it, and I stared at them. "Where will the name come from?" I asked. "The bell should have sounded it," Alyosha said shortly. She put it down. It clanged again softly, an echo of that deep note, and she glared at it. No one knew what to do with me after that. After they all stood in silence for a moment, while Father Balo made noises about the irregularity, the falcon, he still seemed determined to be amused by everything to do with me, said lightly, "Perhaps our new witch should choose a name for herself." Ragastok said, "I think it more appropriate we choose a name for her." I knew better than to let him have any part in picking my name. Surely, I'd end up as the piglet or the earthworm. But it all felt wrong to me anyway. I'd gone along with the elaborate dance of the thing, but I knew abruptly I didn't want to change my name for a new one that trailed magic around behind it any more than I wanted to be in this fancy gown with its long dragging train that picked up dirt from the hallways. I took a deep breath and said, "There is nothing wrong with the name I already have." So I was presented to the court as Agnieszka of Dvernik. I half regretted my refusal during the presentation. Ragastok had told me, I think meaning to be nasty, that the ceremony would only be a little thing, and that the king didn't have much time to spare for such events when they came out of the proper season. It seems ordinarily new wizards were put onto the list in the spring and the fall, at the same time as the new knights. If he was telling the truth, I could only be grateful for it, standing at the end of that great throne room with a long red carpet like the lolling tongue of some monstrous beast stretched out towards me. and crowds of glittering nobility on either side of it, all of them staring at me and whispering to one another behind their voluminous sleeves. I didn't feel like my real self at all. I would almost have liked another name on me then. A disguise to go with my clumsy, wide-skirted dress. I set my teeth and picked my way down the endless hall until I came to the dais and knelt at the king's feet. He still looked weary, as he had in the courtyard when we'd come. The dark gold crown banded his forehead, and it must have been an enormous weight. But it wasn't that simple kind of tiredness. His face, beneath his brown and gray beard, had lines like Christina's, the lines of someone who couldn't rest for worrying about the next day. He put his hands around mine, and I squeaked out the words of the oath of fealty, stumbling over them. He answered me with long and easy practice, took his hands back, and nodded for me to go. A page began making little beckoning motions at me from the side of the throne, but I realized belatedly that this was the first and just as likely only chance I had to ask the king anything. "Your Majesty, if you please," I said, trying hard to ignore the looks of puffing indignation from everyone near enough the throne to hear me. "I don't know if you read Sarkhan's letter." One of the tall, strong footmen by the throne almost at once got my arm, bowing to the king with a fixed smile on his face, and tried to tug me away. I planted my feet, muttering a sliver of Yaga's earth spell, and ignored him. "We have a real chance to destroy the wood now," I said. "But he hasn't any soldiers. And yes, I'll go in a moment," I hissed at the footman, who'd now got me by both my arms and was trying to rock me off the dais. "I only need to explain."
"All right, Bartosz, stop breaking your back on her," the king said. "We can give our newest witch a moment."
He was really looking at me now, for the first time, and sounding faintly amused.
"We have indeed read the letter. It could have used a few more lines, not least about you."
I bit my lip.
"What would you ask of your king?"
My mouth trembled on what I really wanted to ask. "Let Kasha go!" I wanted to cry out. But I couldn't. I knew I couldn't. That was selfishness. I wanted that for me, for my own heart's sake, and not for Polnia. I couldn't ask that of the king, who hadn't even let his own queen go without facing trial. I dropped my eyes from his face to the tips of his boots, gold embossed and just curling from underneath the fur trim of his robes. "Men, to fight the wood," I whispered. "As many as you can spare, Your Majesty."
"We cannot easily spare any," he said. He held up a hand when I drew breath. "However, we will see what can be done. Lord Spitko, look into the matter. Perhaps a company can be sent."
A man hovering by the side of the throne bowed acknowledgement. I tottered away, suffused with relief. The footman eyed me narrowly as I went past him and through a door behind the dais. It led me into a smaller antechamber, where a royal secretary, a severe older gentleman, with an expression of strong disapproval, stiffly asked me to spell my name. I think he had heard some of the scene I'd created outside. He wrote my name down in an enormous leather-bound tome at the heading of a page. I watched closely to be sure he put it down right, and ignored the disapproval, too glad and grateful to care. The king didn't seem at all unreasonable. Surely he would pardon Kasha at the trial. I wondered if perhaps we might even ride out with the soldiers and join Sarkhan at Zatochik together to start the battle against the wood. "When will the trial begin?" I asked the secretary
when he had finished writing my name. He only gave me an incredulous stare, lifted from the letter he'd already turned his attention to. "I surely cannot say," he said, and then sent his stare from me to the door leading out of the room, the hint as pointed as a pitchfork. "But isn't there... It must start soon," I tried. He had already looked back down at his letter. This time, he raised his head even more slowly, as if he couldn't believe I was still there. "It will begin," he said, with awful enunciated precision, "whenever the king decrees." Chapter 19. 3 days later, the trial still hadn't begun, and I hated everyone around me. Sarkhan had told me there was power to be had here, and I suppose for someone who understood the court, there would have been. I could see there was a kind of magic in having my name written down in the king's book. After speaking to the secretary, I had gone back to my tiny room, baffled and uncertain what to do next, and before I had been sitting on my bed for half an hour, the maids had knocked 5 times, carrying cards of invitation to dinners and parties. I thought the first one was a mistake, but even after I realized they couldn't all have gone astray, I still had no idea what to do with them or why they were coming.
"I see you are already in demand," Sole said, stepping out of a shadow and through my doorway before I could close it after yet another maid delivering yet another card. "Is this something we're supposed to do?" I asked warily. I had begun to wonder if perhaps this was a duty of the king's wizards. "Do these people need some kind of magic done?"
"Oh, it might come to that eventually," he said. "But at the moment, all they want is the privilege of displaying the youngest royal witch ever named. There are already 12 rumors flying about your appointment." He plucked the cards out of my hands, shuffled through them, and handed one out to me. "Countess Boguslava is by far the most useful. The count has the king's ear, and he's sure to be consulted about the queen. I'll take you to her soiree."
"No, you won't," I said.
"You mean they just want me to come and visit? But they don't even know me."
"They know enough," he said in patient tones. "They know you are a witch. My dear, I really think you would be better off accepting my escort for your first outing. The court can be difficult to navigate if you are unfamiliar with its ways. You know that we want the same thing. We want the queen and Kasha acquitted."
"You wouldn't give a crust of bread to save Kasha," I said. "And I don't like the way you go about getting the things you want."
He didn't let me chase away his manners. He only politely bowed himself backwards into the shadows in the corner of my room. "I hope you'll learn to think better of me by and by." His voice floated distantly out of the dark, even as he vanished. "Do keep in mind that I am ready to be your friend if you find yourself at sea." I threw the card from Countess Boguslava after him. It fluttered to the ground in the empty corner. I didn't trust him at all, though I couldn't help but worry he was telling me part of the truth. I was beginning to understand how little I understood about the life of the court. To listen to Solya, if I showed my face at the party given by a woman who didn't know me, she would be pleased and tell her husband so, and he'd tell the king that the queen shouldn't be put to death, and the king would listen? None of that made sense to me, but neither did strangers sending me a pile of invitations, all because a man had written my name down in a book. But here were the invitations. So plainly, I was missing steps along the way. I wished I could speak to Sarkhan, half for advice, half to complain at him. I even opened up Yaga's book
and hunted through it for a spell that would let me reach him. But I didn't find anything that seemed as though it could work. The closest was one called Kjalmas, with the note, to be heard in the next village. But I didn't think anyone would appreciate me shouting so loudly that my voice would go a week's distance across the country, and I didn't think the mountains would let the noise through anyway, even if I deafened everyone in Kralia. In the end, I picked out the earliest dinner invitation and went. I was hungry anyway. The last of the bread I'd saved in my skirt pocket was so stale by now that even magic couldn't make it go down easily or really fill my belly. There had to be kitchens somewhere in the castle, but the servants eyed me oddly when I went too far down the wrong hallway. I didn't want to imagine their faces if I went sailing into the kitchens, but I couldn't bring myself to stop one of those maids, a girl just like me, and ask her to serve me, as though I really thought myself a fine lady, instead of just dressed up pretending to be one. I roamed up and down stairs and through hallways until I found my way back out to the courtyard. And there I girded myself and went to one of the guards on the door and asked him the way, showing him my invitation. He gave me the same odd look the servants did, but he looked at the address and said, "It's the yellow one, third inn from the outer gate. Go down the road and you'll see it after you get around the cathedral. Do you want a chair, my lady?" He tacked on the last, doubtfully. "No," I said, confused by the question, and set off. It wasn't a very long walk. The nobles lived in houses set inside the outer walls of the citadel, or the richest ones did anyway. The footman at the yellow house stared at me too when I finally walked up to the entrance, but they opened the doors for me. I stopped on the threshold. It was my turn to stare. On my way, I had gone by more than one pair of men carrying peculiar tall boxes around the castle grounds. I hadn't known what they were for. Now one of them was being carried to the steps of the house, right behind me. A footman opened up the door in its side, and there was a chair inside it. A young lady climbed out. The footman offered her a hand to step out onto the stairs of the house, but then he went back to his place. She posed on the lower step, looking up at me. I asked her doubtfully, "Do you need help?" She didn't stand as though she had a bad leg, but I couldn't tell what was beneath her skirts, and I couldn't imagine any other reason she would have shut herself up into such a bizarre thing. But she only stared at me, and then two more of the chairs came up behind her, discharging more guests behind her. It was just how they went from place to place. "Do none of you ever walk?" I asked, baffled. "And how do you keep from getting all over mud?" she said. We both looked down. I was a good 2 inches deep in mud along all the bottom of today's skirt, bigger around than a wagon wheel and made of purple velvet and silver lace. "I don't," I said glumly. That was how I met Lady Alicia of Litzvar. We walked into the house and were immediately interrupted by our hostess, who appeared in the hall between us, greeted Lady Alicia very perfunctorily, then seized my arms and kissed me on both cheeks.
"My dear Lady Agnieszka," she said, "how lovely that you were able to come. And what a charming gown. You are sure to start a new fashion."
I stared at her beaming face in dismay. Her name had gone completely out of my head, but it didn't seem to matter. Even while I mumbled something polite and grateful, she twined her perfumed arm around mine and drew me into the sitting room where her guests were gathered. She paraded me around to everyone there, while I silently and fervently hated Solya all the more for being right. Everyone was so very glad to make my acquaintance,
Everyone was scrupulously polite, at first anyway. They didn't ask me for magic. What they did want was gossip about the Queen's rescue. Their manners were too nice to ask questions outright, but each of them said something like, "I've heard that there was a chimera guarding her?" letting the words trail off expectantly, inviting me to correct them. I could have said anything. I could have passed it off in some clever way or claimed any number of marvels. They were plainly ready to be impressed with me, to let me assume a heroic role. But I recoiled from the memory of that dreadful slaughter all around me, of blood watering the earth into mud. I flinched and blundered, answering with a flat no, or saying nothing at all, and dropping one conversation after another into an awkward hole of silence. My disappointed hostess finally abandoned me in a corner near a tree. There was an orange tree growing inside the house, in the pot, and went to smooth over the ruffled feathers of her other guests. It was perfectly clear to me that if there was any good I could have done Kasia here, I'd just done the opposite. I was grimly wondering if I should swallow my reluctance and go find Soli after all, when Lady Alicia appeared at my elbow. "I didn't realize you were the new witch," she said, taking my arm and leaning in conspiratorially. "Of course you don't need a sedan chair. Do tell me, do you travel by turning yourself into an enormous bat? Like Baba Yaga?" I was glad to talk about Yaga, about anything besides the wood, and even more glad to find someone other than Solia willing to show me how to go on. By the time we finished dinner, I had agreed to go with Lady Alicia to a breakfast and a card party and a dinner the next day. I spent the next 2 days almost entirely in her company. I didn't think us friends exactly. I wasn't in the mood to make friends. Every time I trudged back and forth from the castle to yet another party, I had to pass by the barracks of the royal guard, and in the middle of their courtyard stood the stark iron block, scorched and black, where they beheaded the corrupted before they burned their corpses. Alyosha's forge stood nearby, and more often than not, her fire was roaring, her silhouette raising showers of orange sparks with a hammer made of shadow. "The only mercy you can give the corrupted is a sharpened blade," she had said when I tried to persuade her to at least visit Kasia once herself. I couldn't help but think maybe she was working on the headman's axe right then, while I sat in stuffy rooms and ate fish eggs on toast with the crust cut off and tea sweetened with sugar, and tried to talk to people I didn't know. But I did think Lady Alicia was kind, taking a clumsy peasant girl under her wing. She was only a year or two older than me, but already married to a rich old baron who spent most of his days at card parties. She seemed to know everyone. I was grateful and determined to be grateful, and I felt half guilty for not being better company or understanding the manners of the court. I didn't know what to say when Lady Alicia insisted on paying me loud and intensely fervent compliments on the excessive lace on my gown, or on the way I mangled the steps of a courtly dance when she persuaded some poor, goggled-eyed young nobleman to take me on, much to the dismay of his toes and the amused stares of the room. I didn't realize she was mocking me all the time, until the third day. We'd planned to meet at the afternoon music party held at the house of a baroness. There was music at all the parties, so I didn't understand what made this one especially a music party. Alicia had just laughed when I'd asked her. But I dutifully tramped over after lunch, trying my best to hold up my long silver frost train and balance the matching headdress, a long curved heavy swoop over my head that wanted to fall either backwards or forwards, either way, as long as it didn't stay in place. Coming into the room, I caught the train in the doorway and stumbled,
and the headdress went sliding back over my ears. Alicia caught sight of me and crossed the room in a dramatic rush to clasp my hands.
"Dearest," she said urgently, breathlessly, "what a brilliant original angle! I've never seen anything like it before!"
I blurted out, Are you trying to be rude?" As soon as the idea occurred to me, all the odd things she'd said and done came together and made a strange, malicious sense. But I couldn't believe it at first. I didn't understand why she would have. No one had made her talk to me or be in my company. I couldn't understand why she would have gone to the trouble just to be unpleasant. Then I couldn't doubt it anymore. She put on a wide-eyed, surprised expression that plainly meant, yes, she was trying to be rude.
"Why, Neshka?" she began, as though she thought I was an idiot, too.
I pulled my hands free from hers with a jerk, staring at her. "Agnieszka will do," I said, startled and sharp. "And since you like my style so much..."
"Kadburu!"
Her own curved headdress tipped backwards down her head and took with it the elaborate lovely curls to either side of her face, which were evidently false. She gave a small scream and clutched at them and ran out of the room. That wasn't the worst of it, though. Worse was the titter that went all around the room from men I'd seen her dance with and women she'd called her intimate friends. I jerked off my own headdress and hurried over to the lavish refreshments, hiding my face from the room over bowls of grapes. Even there, a young man in an embroidered coat that must have taken some woman a year of work sidled up to my side and whispered in tones of glee that Alicia wouldn't be able to show her face at court for a year, as though that should have pleased me. I managed to duck away from him into a servant's hallway, and then, in desperation, I pulled out Yaga's book from my pocket until I found a spell for a quick exit to let me pass through the wall of the house instead of going back inside and out the front door. I couldn't bear to hear any more poisonous congratulations. I came out through the yellow brick wall, panting like I'd escaped from a prison. A small lion-mouthed fountain stood gurgling away in the center of the plaza, the afternoon sun dazzling and captured in the basin, and a carved flock of birds around the top, singing softly. I could tell at a glance it was Ragastok's work. And there was Solya, perched on the edge of the fountain, running his fingers through the light in the water.
"I am glad to see you've rescued yourself," he said. "Even though you walked yourself into it as determinedly as you possibly could."
He hadn't been in the house at all, but I was sure he knew every detail of Alicia's mortification and mine, and for all his sorrowful expression, I was sure he'd been delighted to watch me make a fool of myself. All the time I'd been grateful that Alicia didn't want my magic or my secrets, it had never occurred to me that she might want something else. Even if it had, I wouldn't have imagined she'd been looking for a target for malice. We weren't stupidly cruel to each other in Dvernik. Of course there were quarrels sometimes, and people you liked less, and sometimes even a fight broke out, if people got angry enough. But when harvest came, your neighbors came to help you gather and thresh, and when the shadow of the wood stole over us, we knew better than to make it any darker. And none of us would have been rude to a witch, no matter what. I would have thought even a noble woman had more sense than that, I said.
Solya shrugged. Perhaps she didn't believe you one.
I opened my mouth to protest that she'd seen me do magic, but I suppose she hadn't. Not like Ragastok, who would burst into rooms like a thunderclap with showers of glittering silver sparks and birds calling as they flew out in every direction. Not even like Solya, gliding smoothly in and out of shadows in his elegant robes, with those bright, sharp eyes of his that seemed to see everything that went on in the castle grounds. I shoved myself into ball gowns in my own room and walked to parties stubbornly, and in a strangling corset that was quite enough to spend my breath on without doing tricks just to show off. But how did she think I got myself on the list? I demanded.
I imagine she thought what the rest of the wizards did at first.
What? That you put me on because Sarkhan was in love with me? I said sarcastic.
Marek, more likely. He said entirely serious, and I stared at him appalled.
Really, Agnieszka, I would have expected you to understand that much by now.
I don't want to understand any of this, I said. Those people in there, they were happy for Alicia to mock me, and then they were just as happy for me to make her miserable.
Of course, he said. They're delighted to learn that you were playing the yokel only to set up an elaborate mockery of the first person who took your bait. That makes you part of the game.
I didn't set a trap for her, I said. I wanted to add that no one would think of something like that, no one in their right mind anyway, only I had the unpleasant sticky feeling that some of these people would.
No, I didn't imagine you had, Sole said judiciously. But you may want to let people believe you did. They will anyway, no matter what you say.
He stood up from the edge of the fountain.
The situation's not beyond repair. I think you'll find people much friendlier to you at the dinner tonight. Won't you let me escort you after all? For answer, I turned on my pointed heel and stalked away from him and his amused huff of laughter, letting my stupid train drag along the ground behind me. I made my thundercloud way out of the neat courtyard and into the noisy bustle of the green outer courtyard of the castle. A heap of hay bales and barrels sat alongside the main road from the outer gate to the inner ones, waiting to be loaded somewhere or other. I sat down on one bale to think. I had the horrible certain feeling that Soli was right about this, too. And that meant any courtier who would speak to me now would only do so because they liked this sort of spiteful game. Anyone decent wouldn't want anything to do with me. But there wasn't anyone else I could talk to, or even ask for advice. The servants and soldiers didn't want any part of me either, nor the officials hurrying on their appointed rounds. As they came past me now, I could see them all throwing doubtful looks in my direction. A fine lady sitting on a hay bale next to the road, in my satin and lace finery, my dragging train full of grass and sand, a stray leaf in a well-tended garden. I didn't belong. Worse than that, I wasn't being any use to Kasha or to Sarkhan or anyone back home. I was ready to testify, and there wasn't a trial. I'd begged for soldiers, but none had gone. I'd attended more parties in 3 days than in my whole life before, and I had nothing to show for it but ruining the reputation of one silly girl who'd probably never had a real friend in her life. In a burst of frustration and anger, I called Vanastalem, but slurred deeply, and between one passing wagon and the next, I put myself back into the clothes of a woodcutter's daughter, good plain homespun, a skirt that wasn't too long for sensible boots to show beneath it, an apron with two big pockets in it. I breathed easier at once, and found myself suddenly invisible. No one was looking at me anymore. No one cared who I was or what I was doing. There were hazards to invisibility, too. While I stood there, on the edge of the road, enjoying the pleasure of a deep breath, an enormous carriage swollen out over its wheels on all sides, and 4 footmen hanging off it, came rattling past me and nearly knocked me over.
I had to jump out of the way into a puddle, my boots squelching and mud sputtering my skirts. But I didn't care. I knew myself for the first time in a week, standing on earth instead of polished marble. I went back up the hill in the carriage track, my stride swinging wide and free in my easy skirts, and slipped into the inner court without any trouble. The fat carriage had drawn up to disgorge an ambassador in a white coat, a red sash of office brilliant across his chest. The crown prince was there to meet him, with a crowd of courtiers and an honor guard carrying the flag of Polonia and a yellow and red flag with the head of an ox upon it, one I'd never seen before. He must have been coming to the state dinner. I'd been meant to go there with Alicia this evening. All the guards were watching the ceremony with half an eye at least, and when I whispered to them that I wasn't worth taking any notice of, their eyes slid over me the way they wanted to anyway. Going back and forth from parties three times a day from my inconvenient room had been good for one thing at least. I had learned to find my way about the castle. There were servants in hallways, but all of them were laden under linens and silver, hurrying to make ready for the dinner party. None of them had attention to spare for a mud-sputtered scullery maid. I eeled around and through them, and made my way down the long dark corridor to the great tower. The four guards on duty, at the base of the tower, were bored and yawning with the late hour.
"You missed the stair to the kitchen, sweetheart," one of them said good-naturedly to me. "It's back down the hall."
I stored that information away for later, and then I did my best to stare at them the way that everyone had been staring at me for the last 3 days, as though I were perfectly astonished by their ignorance. "Don't you know who I am?" I said. "I'm Agnieszka, the witch. I'm here to see Kasia, and to have a look at the queen, more to the point." I couldn't think why the trial would be put off so long, unless the king was trying to give the queen more time to get well. The guards all looked at each other uncertainly. Before they could decide what to do about me, I whispered, "Alamak, alamak," and walked straight on through the locked doors between them. They weren't nobles, so I suppose they weren't inclined to pick a quarrel with a witch. They didn't come after me, at least. I climbed the narrow staircase, around and around, until I came out onto the landing with the hungry imp knocker gaping at me. Taking the round knob felt as though my hand was being licked thoroughly by a lion that was deciding whether or not I would taste good. I held it as gingerly as I could and banged on the door. I had a list of arguments for the willow, and behind them fled determination. I was ready to shove my way past her if I had to. She was too much a fine lady to lower herself to wrestling with me, I suspected. But she didn't come to the door at all, and when I pressed my ear to it, I faintly heard shouting inside. In alarm, I backed up and tried to think. Would the guards be able to knock the door down if I shouted for them? I didn't think so. The door was made of iron and riveted with iron, and there wasn't even a keyhole to be seen. I looked at the imp, which leered back. Hunger radiated from its empty maw. But if I filled it up? I called a simple spell, just some light. The imp immediately began to suck the magic in, but I kept feeding power to the spell until finally a little candle-wavering gleam lit in my hand. The imp's hunger was an enormous pool, guzzling in nearly all the magic I could give, but I managed to divert a narrow silver stream. I let it collect into a tiny pool inside me, and then squeezed out. Alamak! And with one desperate jump, I went through the door. It took all the strength I had left. I rolled out onto the floor of the room beyond, and sprawled flat on my back, emptied. Footsteps came running across the floor to me, and Kasia was at my side.
"Agnieszka, are you all right?"
The shouting was from the next room. Marek, standing, fist clenched in the middle of the floor, and roaring at the willow, who stood ramrod stiff and white with anger. Neither of them paid much attention to my falling in through the door. They were too busy being furious at each other.
Look at her!
Marek flung an arm out at the queen. She still sat by the same window as before, listless and unmoved. If she heard the shouting, she didn't so much as flinch.
3 days without a word from her lips, and you call yourself a healer? What use are you?
None, evidently, the willow said icily. All I have done is everything that could be done, as well as it could be done. She did take notice of me then, finally. She turned and looked down her nose at me on the floor.
I understand this is the miracle worker of the kingdom. Perhaps you can spare her from your bed long enough to do better. Until then, tend her yourself. I am not going to stand here to be howled at for my efforts.
She marched past me, twitching her skirts to one side so they wouldn't even brush up against mine, as if she didn't care to be contaminated. The bar lifted itself at a flick of her hand. She swept out, and the heavy iron door clanged shut behind her, scraping on the stone like an axe blade coming down. Marek turned on me, his temper still unspent.
And you! You're meant to be the foremost witness, and you're wandering the castle looking like a kitchen slut. Do you think anyone is going to believe a word out of your mouth? 3 days since I got you on the list. You got me, I said indignantly, wobbling up to my feet with the support of Kasha's arm. And all you've done is persuade the entire court you are a useless bumpkin. Now this? Where is Solia? He was supposed to be showing you how to go on.
I don't want to go on, I said. I don't care what any of these people think of me. What they think doesn't matter.
Of course it matters.
He seized me by the arm and dragged me out of Kasha's hands. I stumbled with him, trying to gather together a spell to knock him away, but he pulled me to the window sill and pointed down to the castle courtyard. I paused and looked down, puzzled. There didn't seem to be anything alarming happening. The red-sashed ambassador was just going into the building with Crown Prince Zygmunt.
That man with my brother is an envoy from Mondria, Marek said low and savage. Their prince consort died last winter. The princess will be out of mourning in 6 months. Now do you understand?
No, I said baffled.
She wants to be queen of Polnia, Marek shouted.
But the queen's not dead, Kasha said. And then we understood. I stared at Marek, cold, horrified.
But the king, I blurted. He loved...
I stopped.
He's putting the trial off to buy time. Do you understand? Marek said. Once memories of the rescue have faded, he'll get the nobility to look the other way. And then he can put her quietly to death. Now, are you going to help me? Or do you want to keep blundering around the castle until the snow flies and they burn her and your beloved friend here, once it's too cold for anyone to come out and watch?
I curled my fingers tight around Kasha's stiff hand, as if I could protect her that way. It felt too cruel and hollow to imagine that we could have won Queen Hanna free, brought her out of the wood, all so the king could cut off her head and marry someone else. Just to add a principality to the map of Polnia, another jewel to his crown. But he loved her, I said again, a protest I couldn't help making, stupidly, I suppose. Yet that story, the story of the lost beloved queen, made more sense to me than the one Marek was telling me.
And you think that would make him forgive being made a fool? Marek said. His beautiful wife, who ran away from him with a Russian boy who sang her charming songs in the garden. That's what they said of her, until I was old enough to kill men for saying it. They told me not to even mention her name to him when I was a boy. He was staring down at Queen Hannah in her chair, where she sat blank as waiting paper. In his face, I could see him as he'd been, a child, hiding in his mother's deserted garden, to escape that same crowd of poisonous courtiers, all of them smirking and whispering about her, shaking their heads and pretending at sorrow while they gossiped that they'd known it all along. "And you think we can save her and Kasha by dancing to their music?" I said. He lifted his gaze from the queen and looked at me. For the first time ever, I think he really listened to me. His chest rose and fell 3 times. "No," he said finally, agreeing. "They're all just vultures, and he is the lion. They'll shake their heads and agree it's a shame, and pick at the bones he throws them. Can you force my father to pardon her?" he demanded, as easily as if he wasn't asking me to ensorcel the king and take someone's will away from them, as dreadful as the wood. "No," I said, appalled. I looked at Kasha. She stood with a hand resting on the back of the queen's chair, straight and golden and steady, and she shook her head to me. She wouldn't ask that of me. She wouldn't even ask me to run away with her, to abandon our people to the wood, even if it meant the king would murder her just so he could kill the queen too. I swallowed. "No," I said again, "I won't do that." "Then what will you do?" Marek snarled, angry again, and stalked from the room without waiting for me to answer. It was just as well. I didn't know what to say.
Chapter 20. The guards on the Charovnikov did recognize me, despite my clothes. They opened the heavy wooden doors for me and swung them closed again. I stood with my back pressed up to them, the gilt and turning angels overhead, and the endless walls of books looming all the way down one wall and back along the next, dipping into alcoves and back out again. There were a handful of other people working at the tables here and there, young men and women in robes with their heads bent over alembics or books. They didn't pay attention to me. They were all busy themselves. The Charovnikov wasn't welcoming to me, colder than the Dragon's Library, and too impersonal. But at least it was a place I understood. I still didn't know how I was going to save Kasha, but I knew I had more chance of finding a way to do it here than I did in a ballroom. I took hold of the nearest ladder and dragged it squeaking all the way to the very front of the very first shelf. Then I tucked up my skirts, climbed up to the top, and began to rummage. It was a familiar kind of searching. I didn't go gleaning in the forest to find something in particular. I went to find whatever there was to find, and to let ideas come to me. If I found a heap of mushrooms, we'd have mushroom soup the next day. And if I found flat stones, the hole in the road near our house would get mended. I thought, surely, there had to be at least a few books here that would speak out to me, like Yaga's book. Maybe they even had another one of hers, somewhere hidden away, among all these fancy gold-stamped volumes. I worked as quickly as I could. I looked at the dustiest books, the ones least used. I ran my hands over all of them, read the titles of their spines. But it was slow going, no matter what, and full of frustration. After I had gone through 12 wide bookcases, ceiling to floor, 30 shelves on each, I began to wonder if I would find anything here after all. There was a dry, stiff feeling to all the books beneath my hands, and nothing that invited me to keep looking. It had grown late while I worked. The handful of other students were gone, and the magical lights had dimmed down to the faint glow of hot ash all along the library, as though they had gone to sleep. Only the one on my shelf still shone firefly bright, and my back and ankles were complaining. I was twisted up on the ladder, my foot hooked around the rail, so I could reach out and grab the farthest books. I'd barely made it a quarter of the way down one side of the room, and that was going as quick and slipshod as I could. Not a tenth of the books looked at properly. Sarkin would have muttered something uncomplimentary.
"What are you looking for?"
I nearly pitched off the ladder onto Father Balo's head, just barely catching the side rail in time and barking my ankle painfully on the joint. There was a section of one of the bookshelves standing open halfway down the room, the door to some hidden nook. He'd come out of there. He was carrying four thick volumes in his arms, which I supposed he meant to put back on the shelves, and staring up at me doubtfully from the floor. I was still twitching inwardly with surprise, and I spoke without thinking. "I'm looking for Sarkin," I said. Balo looked blankly at the shelves I'd been pawing over. Did I think I was going to find the dragon pressed between the pages of a book? But as if I'd told myself at the same time as him, I realized that was exactly what I was after. I wanted Sarkin. I wanted him to look up from among his heaped books and snap at me at the disorder I'd created. I wanted to know what he was doing, if the wood had struck back. I wanted him to tell me how I could persuade the king to let Kasha go. "I want to speak to him," I said. "I want to see him." I already knew there wasn't a spell in Yaga's book, and Sarkin had never shown me such a spell himself. "Father, what spell would you use if you wanted to talk to someone in another part of the kingdom?" But Balo was already shaking his head at me. "Far speaking is a thing of fairy tales, however convenient bards find the notion," he said in lecturing tones. "In Venezia, they have discovered the art of laying a spell of communion within a pair of mirrors made together from the same pool of quicksilver. The king has such a mirror, with the mate carried by the chief of the army at the front. But even these can speak only with one another. The king's grandfather purchased them in exchange for 5 bottles of Fireheart," he added, making me squeak involuntarily at the price. "You might as well buy a kingdom." "Magic may extend the senses, extend sight and hearing. It may amplify the voice or conceal it into a knot to emerge later. It cannot fling your visage across half a kingdom in an instant, or carry someone's voice back to you." I listened to him dissatisfied, although it made unfortunate sense. Why would Sarkin ever send a messenger or write a letter if he could simply cast a spell? It was sensible enough. The same way he could only use his transporting spell to go around the valley, his own territory, and not leap straight to the capital and back. "Are there any other spell books like Yaga's here that I might look in?" I asked, even though I knew Balo didn't have any use for her. "My child, this library is the heart of the scholarship of magic in Polnia," he said. "Books are not flung onto these shelves by the whim of some collector, or through the chicanery of a bookseller. They're not here because they're valuable, or painted in gold to please some noble's eye. Every volume added has been carefully reviewed by at least 2 wizards in the service of the crown. Their virtues have been confirmed, and at least 3 correct workings attested. And even then, they must be of real power to merit a place here. I myself have spent nearly my entire life of service pruning out the lesser works, the curiosities and the amusements of earlier days. You will certainly not find anything like that here." I stared down at him. His entire life! And he would surely have pounced instantly on anything that I could use. I took the sight of the letter
and slid myself to the foot, to his pinched, disapproving look. I suppose he would have stared to see anyone climb a tree, too.
Did you burn them? I said, hopelessly.
He recoiled, as if I'd suggested burning him. A book need not be magical to be of value, he said. Indeed, I would have liked to move them to the university's collection for more thorough study. But Alyosha insisted on their being kept here, under lock, which I cannot deny is a sensible precaution, as such books can attract the worst sort of elements of lower society. Occasionally, enough of the gift crops up to make a street apothecary dangerous if they get the wrong book in their hands. However, I do believe the university archivists, who are men of excellent training, might, with the proper instruction and a rigorous scheme of oversight, have been entrusted with the safekeeping of lesser...
Where are they?
I interrupted. The tiny room he showed me to was crammed full of old, ragged-edged books, with not even an arrow-slit window for air. I had to leave the door cracked open. I was happier rummaging through these messy heaps, where I didn't have to worry about putting them back in any order. But most of the books were just as useless to me as the ones on the shelves. I pushed aside any number of dry histories of magic, and others that were tomes of elaborate small cantrips, at least half of which would have taken twice as long and made five times the mess of doing whatever they wanted to do by hand, and others that seemed perfectly reasonable, formal spellbooks to me, but evidently hadn't met Father Balow's more rigorous standards. There were stranger things in the piles. One very peculiar volume looked just like a spellbook, full of mysterious words and pictures, diagrams like those in many of the dragon's books, and writing that made no sense. After I lost 10 solid minutes to puzzling over the thing, I realized slowly that it was mad. I mean, a madman had written it, pretending he was a wizard, wanting to be one. It wasn't real spells at all, just made up ones. There was something hopelessly sad about it. I pushed that one away into a dark corner. Then finally, my hand fell on one small thin black book. On the outside, it looked like my mother's recipe book for dishes to serve on holidays, and it felt warm and friendly to me at once. The paper was cheap, yellowing and crumbly, but it was full of small, comfortable spells, sketched out in the neat hand. I looked through the pages, smiling down at it involuntarily, and then I looked at the inside of the front cover. In that same neat hand was written, Maria Alshankina, 1267. I sat looking down at it, surprised and not surprised at the same time. This witch had lived in my valley more than 300 years ago, not long after the valley had been settled. The big cornerstone on Alshanka's stone church, the oldest building in the valley, was engraved with the year 1214. Where had Yaga been born? I wondered suddenly. She had been Rosian. Had she lived in the valley on the other side of the wood before Polnia settled it from the other direction? I knew it wasn't going to help me. It was a warm, kind presence in my hands, but with the kindness of a friend who sits with you in comfort by the fire and can't change what's wrong. There were folk witches who cured some kinds of sickness and dealt with crop blight in most big towns. I think Maria had been one of them. For a moment I saw her, a big cheerful woman, with a red apron, sweeping out her front yard, children and chickens underfoot, going inside to brew up some cough potion for an anxious young father with a sick baby at home, pouring it into his cup with a lecture on running across town without a hat on. There had been something gentle in her. A pool of magic, not a running stream that had washed away all the ordinary parts of her life. I sighed and put the book into my pocket anyway. I didn't want to leave it here,
thrown away and forgotten. I found two more like that among the thousands of tumbled books and paged through them. They had a few useful